morning.
Good morning.
So this morning, I'm going to talk about brain plasticity and enlightenment. And I'm going to use the approach that I use in my newsletter article, the three approaches to enlightenment, which is out on the porch. So, starting out with and I'm not going to go into the three approaches in a lot of detail because I've done that already. But the first approach to enlightenment from the Heart Sutra that we chant every morning here, from Nagarjuna, whom we're studying in a morning study group, is deconstructive approach. We see all of our constructs, we see all of the ways that we divide the world up, and we see how we get caught by those, and we just see that they're fiction and are able to deconstruct. So we deconstruct our concepts, and then in the Heart Sutra we also deconstruct our immediate sensory experience. It's one thing to deconstruct our ideas of good and bad and self and other and before and after, but to deconstruct our experience of smelling, of tasting, of touching, of hearing, it's a little bit more counterintuitive. I just think it's very counterintuitive. But the work that's been done on brain plasticity the last 40 years supports Nagarjuna, supports the Heart Sutra. No eyes, no ears, no tongue, no body, no mind. No sight, no smell, no taste, no touch, no object of mind. Historically, the brain has been looked at as a machine. It's a machine. And there are different local parts of that machine. There's a local part for auditory sense, for visual sense. And each of those parts are local. And if one of those local parts breaks down, That's it. But the more recent research indicates that the brain really isn't like that. That it's plastic. That it's polysensory. And that we don't really see with our eyes. that we see, but not just with this locality of eye. And so here are a couple of studies that have been done. One study on a bunch of studies of hearing. The thought had been for years that there was no way you could put an implant into the ear, because the ear, at the core, the cochlea, has 33,000 different piano keys. 33,000. And you can't replace those if they start to go. But at that time, they didn't believe that the ear was plastic, that actually you could implant something into the cochlea that trains the cochlea not to depend on 33,000 anymore, but a simple implant so it can adjust. And it can draw on the polysensory ability of the brain. So my friend, whom I'll call Peter, He was hard of hearing for his whole life, and he got a cochlear. About 4 years ago, he got a cochlear implant, and now he hears lots of stuff that he never heard. And I said, "How is that?" And I thought he'd say, "Fabulous." He said, "Oh well, I realized I wasn't missing that much." So. And many studies have been done with people who lost their visual sight, who are blind. in one study by Bach Urita, he determined that skin and its touch receptors could substitute for a retina. And so he developed a device that enabled blind people to see by sitting in a chair with a tactile machine attached to their backs, which developed vision. And of course, this stuff is still pioneering, but it is the current thinking. So that's, Nagarjuna would be happy. That's the deconstruction of these different categories, these different ideas about that we carry with us, even the ideas about sensory locality, and the acknowledgement that within one part of this, the whole thing is here. One part of this organism, one part of this life. So we have that ability to be plastic. Plastic in the sense of fluid, of malleable, of open. Including letting go of the rigidity of the fictional self. So when we chant the Heart Sutra, we start with no eyes, no ears, no this, no that, no this. We go on and on about no this, no that, and the other, right? And then finally we say, using Red Pine's translation, which I like better than the one. Finally, when we've deconstructed all that stuff, we live without walls of the mind. We're able to live without walls of the mind. And we live without walls of the mind, and thus without fear. And thus without fear. So this is what the brain scientists are telling us, but what we knew in our tradition for a while. We've known that for a while. For a long time. So Nagarjuna, after he deconstructs, we were just talking about this on Thursday, he deconstructs everything. And then he says, when you do that, you experience a world at ease. A world at ease. When you're not caught by segmentation, by division, and the criticism and the anxiety that are created by that segmentation. So that's the first component, or the first, I'd say, approach to enlightenment justified by this brain research on plasticity. The second approach is the the first approach I call the no mirror approach. Second approach I call the clear mirror approach, or the unblemished mirror approach. And that's the body is the enlightenment tree, the mind is the mirror of right. Take care to wipe it clean and let no dust alight. So, from that point of view, as you know, we don't need to age psychologically. We don't need to age. It doesn't matter whether we're 20 or 30 or 40 or 80 or 102. We don't need to age psychologically, because through this practice of sitting quietly, doing nothing, noticing the dust in the mind and letting it fall away, we come back to stillness, to right here. And the brain scientists agree. They say that the most common problems of aging, like trouble finding words, for instance, or trouble staying in the present when you're having a conversation, are due to the neglect and atrophy of the attentional system. The attentional system. That's what we're doing in Zazen, is we're coming back to the attentional system. well, due to when we neglect that attentional system, when we let it atrophy, when we let it decay, then our mind ages. And it's only through some kind of practice of attentiveness, and of course, our key one is Zazen, that we can come back to mirror mind and enjoy mirror mind. So the activation of the attentional system also is called it also includes the activation of the nucleus basalis of the brain, and that stuff has to engage for plasticity, for fluidity. You guys have probably seen research about Alzheimer's, right? Some of you have, some of you haven't. If you live to be 85 years old, the chance you get Alzheimer's are 50%. The chance that you get Alzheimer's or dementia are much higher, much, much higher. And the brain scientists say, that's not necessary. As we say, that's not necessary. Take care of your attentional system. Easier said than done, right? Easier said than done. There's something that this guy, what's his name, Norman Doidge, the brain that changes itself, calls the plasticity paradox. And the plasticity paradox says that even though the brain is fluid and plastic and able to attend to anything and learn new things and let go of the past, that the paradox is that through brain noise and habit and addiction, the Play-Doh, the nice soft Play-Doh, hardens, gets very, very hard. And that is what we're up against with psychological aging. The culprit in all this, if there's a culprit, there isn't really a culprit, but from a brain science point of view, the culprit is, one of the culprits is dopamine. Dopamine is a chemical that, a neurotransmitter and a chemical which relays, amplifies, and mediates signals between two brain cells. Only dopamine, there are lots of them, but dopamine is the reward transmitter. So it gives us a good feeling when we accomplish something. It gives us a good feeling when we win a race or get acknowledged. Well, it's also the part of the brain, the chemical part of the brain that is attached to addiction. It gives us an immediate rush through the use of addictive drugs, through alcohol, through some habit that gets us high, whatever the habit is. It motivates us, it gives us a surge of pleasure and confidence, but it also locks us into this making the Play-Doh solid. So some of you guys have just studied addiction much more than I have. And all the different amplifications of addiction. When I've talked about addiction most recently, I've said, well, the prime addiction is the addiction to the fictional self, to the chattering mind. That's the primary addiction. But that addiction doesn't give us a dopamine release. So because we're in pain from that addiction, we go to these secondary addictions, which give us the dopamine. Relieved. Finally. Finally, until it goes away and I want more, right? And in the 21st century, the two biggest new addictions are computer-related, right? Two biggest new addictions are porn, computer porn, big time, immediately reinforcing, especially for men who tend to be more visual, I'm told, by women. How would I know? They have to tell me, right? And computer games, video games, fighting video games, studies on kids doing computer video games and how it really affects their psyches in a major way. So that's why we have the precept. I will refrain from indulging in intoxicants. Or, if we do the original translation, it's, I will refrain from taking intoxicants. But we've kind of loosened it up here. I don't know when we loosened it up. It wasn't very loose at first. It was just taking them. Because once you've got that plasticity hardened up, that Play-Doh hardened up, it's going to take a lot to loosen it. And you just need one surge and you're back to the old hard Play-Doh. So the abstinence model in regard to addictions has a physiological root, I think. So the problem is that when we get this stuff in our system, these addictions, these habitual ways of doing things, carrying around all of this memory, all of this anxiety, there's no room for our beginner's mind. There's no room for our ability just to be here and just to do something new, freshly. So that's why we do Zazen. And that's why the brain scientists recommend to people who are aging, and some of you guys may have read this, they recommend Zazen, although I don't call it Zazen, they recommend meditation, right? But they also recommend things taking on a new activity, which totally is different from what you've done before. Totally different. So if you haven't danced, take up dancing at 65 or 75 or even 85. It's not too late with early dementia. It's not too late with early Alzheimer's. It's not too late with a 40-year-old mind that's been addicted to something, or a 30-year-old mind. It's not too late. If you already know how to dance, don't take up dancing. Because then if you already know how to dance, you'll be able to dance habitually. But you have to come back to big mind, to stillness, to attentiveness. So you take up something you don't know. Like playing a musical instrument, if you don't play a musical instrument. Like dancing, if you don't dance. Like a foreign language that you don't know. Not Spanish, if you studied Spanish when you were a child, but Chinese. Because that alerts your attentional system. That alerts your ability just to be here and open up new pathways and not be stuck in these one track tank pathways that you develop, that we develop. And when we think of our Zen teachers of old, they were pretty good at this plasticity, most of them. Suzuki Roshi was pretty good at it. I mean, he'd been practicing for years. It'd been most of his life. So by the time I knew him, he was in his 60s, and then I guess close to 70. And I've told before about how one of my friends got so depressed that she couldn't practice anymore. She couldn't do Zazen anymore. But she still played tennis. So Suzuki Roshi told me one day he was going out to see Betsy. And I said, "You're going to see her?" He said, "Yes, we're going to play tennis." And I said, "Do you play tennis?" He said, "No." He said, "I will be playing tennis." And then I went out and watched him play tennis. He was awful. And he had his little sailor's cap on, you know, in the sun. He was awful. But who cares? He did it. Awful, not awful. He was with it. And then my friend Trudy invited him to her parents' ranch in something like Idaho. Idaho, whatever it was, one of those states. when after we picked him up at the airport, we said, well, what did he do? And he said, oh, I rode horses. We said, had he ever ridden horses before? He said, no, he'd barely seen a horse. He said, they're big. And then we were at Tassajara Zen Monastery, and we were, this must have been a 9 day, 4 9 days, or when you don't have to sit so much. This must have been at the end of the session or something. We were having a party at night, and we had rock and roll, and we were a little rock and roll area down there. I don't remember much about it, except I remember Suzuki Roshi, and I remember he went into the kitchen and got a pan, and that was his light show. he was using the pan and dancing around, making lights with shining the pan off the lights, off the ceiling. Anyway, I don't know, there he was. little old Japanese man. Brain plasticity. We all have that ability to develop that. Everybody. Not just him, but each of us. So the third approach to enlightenment is Dogen's approach. Not necessarily the best. We shouldn't get too gaga about Dogen. I mean, he's very deep and wonderful, but who says what's best? Everything's best, right? Everything has something to teach us. Anyway, the third approach, which I call in my newsletter article the shattered mirror, because one of the things Dogen talks about is that enlightenment is ever intimate with delusion. ever intimate. Forever intimate with delusion. Sorry. Maybe you should do one of those others instead. But it's true. Do one of those others, you'll find this out. These are just different ways of talking about the same phenomena, right? Ever intimate. As the third ancestor said, within light there is darkness, within darkness there is light. But to do this practice of shining a light on your delusion is the opposite of our habitual way of doing things. Opposite of our addictive way of doing things. Because we're shining a light right there in that darkness. We are turning ghosts into ancestors. Ghosts, we don't know. Ghosts scare us. We don't really get it. It comes up. We think it relates to something in the past. We get a glimmer of it. But in meditation practice, we begin to transform our implicit memories that we embody, our emotional memories that we get stuck on, and gunk up our plasticity into memories which now have a clear context. And so they're just movies on a screen. Or maybe when I was 4, when I was 8, when I was 13 and a half. They're just movies because I see the clarity of it. And it doesn't haunt me anymore. It's an ancestor. We all got a lot of them. But it takes paying close attention. It takes zazen. Sometimes it takes therapy. Sometimes it takes determination and willingness to come back time and time again. So I think I have not told the story before. Actually, I probably have. Yeah, I probably told the story before. So when I first moved here, and I had my young family here in Minnesota, in Minneapolis, when I moved here in Minneapolis, I used to take my daughter to the lake to feed the ducks. My son too, but he was getting a little old for that, so she wasn't. That was fun, but in those days, the geese were beginning to come. They hadn't really taken over like they did a few years ago before some policies were done to eradicate that. The geese used to come, and when the geese would come, I would just notice that my body was getting really rigid. I was backing way off, and I was pulling Aaron way back. Like, I mean, you're like 50 feet back. And I knew this was something, there was something in here, right? But I wasn't quite sure what it was. I had some vague kind of memories. But just by sitting here facing the wall, a few times I saw myself at 4 years old by the lake in San Francisco with my grandfather and these ducks. These not gucks, these huge geese that were as big as me, squawking at me, and I thought they were going to eat me. Really, they were going to. And just seeing that fear, just seeing it, just contextualizing it, is the beginning of freedom. So now when I do that, I say, ducks don't freak me out anymore. Now, I don't want to go up and hug the ducks because it's still there. It's still there. But they don't freak me out. So that's one thing that the brain scientists are talking about, that we can do this kind of transformation, just like we have been talking about in Zen for a long, long time. Another thing they talk about is roadblocks and barriers. Well, of course, I'm very happy to hear them talk about roadblocks and barriers, because Zen students don't like them, nobody likes them, and yet they're such an important part of our practice and our transformation to fluidity, to plasticity. So here's a couple of studies that were done. A group of people were blindfolded for a week, and they were completely blindfolded. They were not allowed to see anything, no light at all. And after a week of being completely blindfolded, they were compared to people who hadn't been blindfolded, and these people were able to distinguish items in their path by their auditory echoes. And the amount of learning that they had done in 1 week was incredible, that sighted people don't have. A second group of people was blindfolded for 5 days, and their visual cortexes, for 5 days they were blindfolded completely too, and then they were studied, and their visual cortexes were studied. And they noticed that their visual cortexes, just after 5 days, were beginning to process the sense of touch that you need for Braille learning. And so the conclusion of this is, what? You have to restrain or block out the most commonly used pathway to get beyond this little local, this little small mind, this little small self. So in sesshins, we're blocking out. In our retreats, in our extended meditation, we're blocking out that self-talk, dominating self-talk. And of course, it doesn't want to be blocked out, but we come back and do it again and again so that we can open to a broader pathway. So that we can go beyond the local, the small mind to big mind. Right? Right? So, and this is part of Zen teaching that goes back to the beginning. Katagiri Roshi used to talk about Samabhadi. He said, oh, I had problems with my teacher. Suzuki Roshi said, oh, I have problems with my teacher. Wiko said about Bodhidharma, oh, I had problems with my teacher. there's the Chinese story. The Chinese Zen stories are all about this kind of thing. There's a Chinese Zen story where John is John here is sitting in front of me, and it's just the two of us, and I'm having dokes on with him, and then I say, time's up, and then he starts to go out that side of the room, and I say, no, don't go out that way. And then he starts, there's another door over here, he starts to go out that way, and I say, no, don't go out that way. And then I'm completely, so my path, so here's an example of pathways. My two pathways are cut off. My rational, small self, how do I go from here to there? Pathways are cut off. And so he says to the teacher, well, where shall I go then? There's no way out. And the teacher says, stay here. Well, those are just, that's just an example, but look at the Chinese literature. That's what it is. Find a Chinese koan that doesn't include your pathway being blocked by your teacher so you can open up. It's hard to find them. Everybody's looking for a few of those. So finally, this third approach to enlightenment talks about something that the brain scientists are very interested in, and that is imagination. Imagination. Now, of course, in traditional Zen, imagination gets put down. In Chinese Zen, gets put down. Oh, it's just, I've talked about this quite a bit. Oh, it's just your fantasy. Oh, just your fantasy. Just flowers in the air. Just delusion. Just fantasy. Let go of all that imagination. It's just your cataracts are causing that fantasy, to use a visual metaphor. But then, of course, Dogen says that's a false dichotomy between imagination and the world. That's you're localizing again. You're segmenting again instead of seeing it as all big mind. And so imagination is important. It's very, very important. And let me read something from Norman Doidge about this. In an experiment that is as hard to believe as it is simple, Drs. Guang Yue and Kelly Cole showed that imagining one is using one's muscles actually strengthens them. The study looked at two groups, one that did physical exercise and one that imagined doing physical exercise. Both groups exercised a finger muscle Monday through Friday for 4 weeks. The physical group did trials of 15 maximal contractions with a 20-second rest between each. I don't know if you want this much detail. The mental group merely imagined doing 15 maximal contractions with a 20-second rest between each, while also imagining a voice shouting at them, harder, harder, harder. That's the Zen teacher, you know. At the end of the study, the subjects who had done physical exercise increased their muscular strength by 30%, as one might expect. Those who only imagined doing the exercise for the same period increased their muscle strength by 22%. And this is one of a whole series of studies that have recently been done. So, imagination. We talk about aspiration. Aspiration for enlightenment. Aspiration to live an enlightened life. Imagining yourself living with calmness, living with generosity, living attentively over and over again is necessary in this practice. But as you see, it's necessary in all practices. Dogen had developed his imagination when he was 8. He lost both of his parents. He would not have practiced with all the ardor that he did if he couldn't imagine himself as the teachers of old. But he imagined himself that way, starting when he was 8 or 9 years old. With that kind of calmness, with that kind of openness, that sort of resiliency and fluidity. And of course, a lot of reason we don't imagine ourselves is that we're afraid. Fear takes over our imagination, and it blocks. It blocks it. It blocks our energy. It blocks our juice. It blocks our sense that zazen is really quite wonderful. It can be playful. It doesn't have to be something we worry about. It's something we just do. So whenever that fear comes up, there's a ghost. There's a ghost. But it's an ancestor. Look at it. See it. Be with it. Bring it to the cushion. So that's what I want to say this morning. A little bit of time if anybody has any questions, comments. Yeah.
You mentioned how zazen is something that reminds you of broken pathways.
Uh-huh.
And I feel like some of what you are not sitting in 8 or 9 years staring at the wall.
Yeah.
Is that too much of a good thing? Or because his mind really widens the broad pathways?
Well, let's remember that that's a metaphor. I can't say, and I wasn't around with Bodhidharma. I know that some of these Tibetan monks go on retreats for up to 2 years. Personally, I think life is so short that a year or two should be enough, especially if you're going to be a bodhisattva. But in our school, we have Bodhidharma as the archetypal hero because we're emphasizing zazen and. But I don't think we should do that in an inflexible way, because the only point of zazen is to increase our flexibility, our malleability, and our attentiveness to all different activities. And that's what I think. What else? Anything else this morning?
You know, a friend of mine named Charlie Gersh, he writes books and does seminars on creativity, so he talks a lot about brain plasticity and how mm-hmm. to encourage that.
Uh-huh.
And he suggests that everyone tries to do something different every day.
Uh-huh.
If you wear your watch on your left
uh-huh.
arm, wear it on
yep.
your right arm. If
yep.
you go into a meeting, always sit in this chair, sit in another chair.
Yep.
And it's interesting, you try something a little bit different every day,
yep.
how that changes your perspective.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, good. Thank you.
I had a thought too.
Pardon?
I had a thought too. I'm a consultant, and oftentimes my particular contract only lasts for 3 months or 6 months. And every time I change, for the first week, maybe 2 weeks, I feel like I'm in a fog where I'm just absorbing new things and trying to get context
mm-hmm.
and everything.
Mm-hmm.
And I've always kind of dreaded that. I mean, I like the new opportunity, but I've dreaded that fog that I knew was going to be coming because everything would be changing and reorganizing. And I guess having listened to you today, I have a whole new perspective on that, because that's the rebuilding, that's the, you know, the kind of the pushing in, kneading the Play-Doh.
That's
because
right.
My Play-Doh gets hard in the old place, but the process of getting it kneaded again is not always pleasant, but the result after I finally get there is something much better. And so I appreciate that. That's very helpful for me.
Mm-hmm.
For that.
Mm-hmm. Good.
It's not a nice process, but it's important.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Great. Anybody else? Yeah, Ben.
Well, it seems like, you know, doing zazen, the freshness that is available in one's consciousness that one can get from doing it, a new activity, it's available from a quality of mind.
Yes.
But I thought whatever the question that was about Bodhidharma, I mean, is there the potential, or what should one be attentive to as a Zazen practitioner in terms of making sure that Zazen does not become an afterthought?
Yes, I think that's very important. Zazen can become atrophy. We can atrophy through Zazen. You know, I just we can atrophy, especially if we go on automatic when we do it. It's very easy for me to get up in the morning, because I've been getting up at the same time, and just not pay attention to the room, to the alarm clock, go downstairs without even knowing I'm going up, without paying attention, get into the zendo. I know how to make my moves now. I know how to do the rounds. I don't have to pay attention. I could be thinking about anything. I could be habituated to this whole exercise, and it wouldn't be the Zen mind. Then I come in and sit down. I know how to sit straight, although it's harder for me as I get older to sit straight. That's good. Actually, that's good. If it were... Here's something I have to pay attention to as I get older. It's hard for me to sit straight. Here's something that makes it so it's harder for me to habituate in Zazen. And I could habituate to my inner program, but I am good actually at letting go of my inner program, whatever, you know, my radio program. But you could habituate to that. You could habituate to your mantra or to your watching your breathing. Of course, Dogen Shikan Taze is supposed to be non-habituation. That's why he doesn't give any instructions about it, right? Because it's just attentiveness, just bare attention. But bare attention means that we can do any kind of habitual or addictive routine and look like we're paying bare attention. So you're right. You're right. So the best thing for me to do would be to... sleep in a different bed every night, put my alarm clock in a different part of the room, put my clothes on differently, come over here, and then when I came over here, I wouldn't have to spend a few minutes becoming attentive in my Zazen, because I'd already be very attentive. Now I might be a little annoyed, but again, enlightenment is ever intimate with delusion. It's ever intimate with delusion. If there's no delusion, there's no enlightenment. Yeah.
For a number of years, it's been a part of my practice to recite Master Hoffman's chant in praise of Zazen before I start doing Zazen. And as recently as 9 months ago, when I was reciting it to somebody, I found myself breaking down in tears. And then it actually been happening. So it was a chant that was finding some places in it that were really important. More recently, I discovered that I can just recite the chant, and my mind can be any place else. The words just come out. It's time to find it in the Supreme.
Good. Good for you. Good for you. Exactly right. Good. Yep. Bill. Good. Anything else? Yeah.
Isn't there a practice, maybe in traditional Japanese sense, Zen monasteries, of somebody, maybe the teacher, shouting some noise, and then students have to respond like instantaneously?
That's right.
So it's kind of checking in to make sure you're there and you're not somewhere else.
That's right. Well, of course, in China, there was no no rhyme or reason to it. The teachers would just shout. But then in Japan, they turned it into a monastic practice the teacher doing it, and the student was supposed to answer what? You guys know what the teacher's supposed to answer.
I don't know.
Hi. Yeah. It means yes. So whatever the teacher shouts at you, you just say, yes, yes. But that comes from China, where there was no rhyme or reason to it. There was just attention, you know. Yeah.
I'm sure no one else is thinking that. I was very caught by the fact that if you just imagine.
funny. Good. Do it. Yeah, do it.
Yeah.
You'll settle for that 8% differential.
Pardon? Oh, can you say that again? Speak a little louder.
Yes, I was just thinking about that idea of if you imagine sitting zazen.
That you don't have to do it. You can just imagine it. You can lie in your bed next door. She lives next door.
But if you do it wholeheartedly.
I have this. I did notice that it was the same amount of time was required.
Yeah.
Bigger exercises.
Exactly.
So I'm trying to imagine if I was actually imagining doing 40 minutes of
sunset.
Yeah.
Don't forget that voice in the background.
Right.
Yeah. So, here we have it. Here we have it. This wonderful opportunity for each of us. For each of us to be young, be youthful until we're gone. Completely youthful. Completely involved.